This is the takeaway for Friday, July 24th, 2015. This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. For sale, hardly used, Iran nuke deal. Any takers?
This isn't a bad deal. This is a god-awful deal. It must be rejected.
A rally of 10,000 people earlier this week near Times Square to protest the Iranian nuclear deal got presidential candidate former New York Governor George Pataki to speak, along with a number of former military and security officials.
Congress must do its job and stand up for the American people, stand up for our safety, and say no to this Iranian deal.
But in Washington, there were some higher-profile presidential candidates on Capitol Hill to criticize the Iran deal. Secretary of State John Kerry faced his old colleagues on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and this is what he heard from at least two Republicans.
With all due respect, you guys have been bamboozled.
I believe you've been fleeced.
Senator James Risch, Republican of Idaho, and Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee and chairman of the committee, both dismissing the deal altogether. Kerry heard similar doubts from presidential candidate Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and he pushed back with a call, Kerry said, for a better plan from his critics.
Nobody has a plan that is articulated, that is reasonable as to how you are going to strengthen this, do something more, when the supreme leader of Iran and the president of Iran and others believe they've signed an agreement with the world. And the rest of the world thinks it's a good agreement. Now, if you think the Ayatollah is going to come back and negotiate again with an American, that's fantasy.
What's fantasy? Is it the prospect of overriding a presidential veto? Is it this deal? We're joined by Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Where's the fantasy? Where's the reality here, Todd?
The reality really for John Kerry and President Obama and Ernie Moniz and the rest of the administration team on this deal is that Republicans are gone. Talk about a fantasy. It's getting a Republican vote for this deal, either to approve the deal or on a veto override in September. The reality is that they need to preserve the support that they have from Democrats. And that's a big part of the sales job. You heard Secretary Kerry defending this deal against Republicans, of course, during the hearings yesterday, but really targeting a lot of his argument, John, toward those Democrats who he thinks that he's going to need to uphold a veto when Congress most likely rejects this deal. Now, let's talk about the Republicans first, because you mentioned Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio gave voice to the concern of many, many conservatives about inspections in this deal, about the fact that Iran is allowed to keep some uranium, about the fact that this deal lifts embargoes on conventional weapons and gives Iran relief from sanctions so that it can use part of its economy, they say eventually, to support Hezbollah and the Houthis and the Iraqi Shias and terrorist groups. Rubio is running for president. Listen to what he had to say to the Secretary of State.
As far as the American sanctions are concerned, this is a deal whose survival is not guaranteed beyond the term of the current president. And by the way, I personally hope that the next president is someone who will remove the national security waiver and reimpose the congressional sanctions that were passed by Congress, because this deal is fundamentally and irreparably flawed.
Although you could listen to that and think that he's conceding that this time around it'll actually pass and that it'll be for a future Republican president to unravel it. Let's talk about the Democrats for a second. Where does Chuck Schumer, the big Democrat from New York, stand?
Well, Chuck Schumer hasn't said where he stands on this deal yet, and he's emblematic of so many other Democrats who are going to be key. Look, Chuck Schumer is the future Democratic leader of the Senate. Chuck Schumer is from New York. Chuck Schumer is a Jewish Democrat, and he said he's going to take August, the rest of July, to review this deal, and that he's not saying anything about where he stands until he gets to review all the details and, frankly, know which way the wind is blowing on this. He's not alone. Lots of other Democrats in Congress are in a similar position. Now, the White House is of the argument that they think they're going to be able to preserve a presidential veto. You need two-thirds of the House and the Senate to bust up a presidential veto. And this is going to be important. John Kerry's message, a lot of it was tacitly aimed at these congressional Democrats yesterday, John, was really about the Ayatollah, about getting a new deal. You heard him say, if we walk away from this deal, that Iran has made with Britain and France, the P5+1, the Chinese, the Russians, the UN to a certain extent, and the United States, and made promises in front of the world, he's never going to come back to the table. John Kerry and Ernest Moniz made the point that before this deal, Iran had 9,000 centrifuges spinning, 1,200 kilograms of enriched uranium, a heavy water reactor, all of that highly reduced or frozen, that they were building a bomb, that if you walk away from this deal, you wind up in a far worse position than you have with the deal. And John, the last message to Democrats, the administration is telling them behind the scenes and in public, we are doing a lot of it's classified, to help Israel. We're going to give Israel new weapons. We're going to give Israel new intelligence cooperation because they're very skittish about this deal. Iran gets a moratorium on conventional weapons lifted after 5 or 8 years. So we're going to be working closely with the Israelis. That's the kind of thing the Schumers really want to hear.
And Israeli lobbyists, according to the Washington Post, are targeting Chuck Schumer, targeting Chris Coons of Delaware,
yeah.
Ron Wyden of Oregon, Ben Cardin of Maryland, Steny Hoyer of Maryland, Brad Sherman of California, Ted Lieu of California, Grace Meng of New York, Juan Vargas of California, and Ted Deutsch of Florida. Is that where this coalition lies?
John, Brad Sherman himself told me that a lot of those Democrats are going to want to announce a position either for or against before the beginning of August, because he said otherwise you're going to spend all of August. I can name you 16 groups who are all going to demand to take meetings with you while you're trying to be on a break in August. That's what he told me.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
Part of the administration's mission to sell the Iran nuclear deal has been to recruit members of the coalition that made it happen. The UK is a member of the P5+1. Sir Peter Westmacott is the British ambassador to the United States. He spent time as a diplomat in Iran before the revolution. The ambassador says that the hard bargaining on numerous individual provisions right up to the very end is the clearest argument against the charge that Iran in any way bamboozled the United States. The big question, he says, is where do we go from here?
We think it is a good outcome. This was a long, painstaking, difficult negotiation, a lot of all-night discussions, a lot of difficult exchanges, but in the end, everybody played their part, including some more surprising parties. And we think that in the circumstances, this was a good deal and far better than all the alternatives as a means of stopping Iran getting nuclear weapons.
And the alternatives being what?
Well, the alternatives, if we hadn't done a deal now, would have been the collapse of the interim deal, which has frozen Iranian nuclear activity for the last 15 months or so. And it would have been unconstrained ability for Iran to get ahead with building nuclear weapons if he wishes to do so. And our specialists tell us that they could only have been 2 to 3 months away from having enough fissile material to make a few bombs.
Which would then have provoked possible intervention militarily by the Israelis or someone else.
Well, it could have provoked all sorts of different things. I don't know for sure who would or wouldn't have tried to take military action. But I think it would have scared the region, and it would certainly have prompted a number of other important countries in that region to think that they better go and buy a nuclear weapon as well.
So an important coalition negotiates a spectacular historic deal in Iran, which no one expected to come out from the cold, and this has happened. Can it be undone by some representatives from Ohio in the House of Representatives?
Well, of course, the United States Congress is now thinking about it. It's got 60 days to express an opinion, perhaps to vote on it. We very much hope that the United States government will be able to put its signature to the final deal, if you like. But to be honest, I think given the amount of effort that's gone into it and given the really poor quality of the alternatives as a means of stopping Iran building nuclear weapons, we very much hope that this deal will now go through, be approved by all the governments that have still got to approve it, and then we can get on with getting the Iranians to implement their side of the deal.
Your chuckle a moment ago made me think that perhaps you don't have a whole lot of faith in the U.S. Congress taking a rational approach to this.
Yeah, it's not for me to comment on what the United States Congress does or doesn't want to do. I've talked to a number of my friends on Capitol Hill. There are some wonderful people there, many of whom are really seriously looking at this thing and trying to work out what is good, what is bad, what's in the United States' national interest, and so on.
What governments in this Vienna negotiation distinguish themselves, and what relationships seem possible here if this becomes a template for another kind of 21st century international cooperation?
You know, I think everybody played their role. The Brits were in there, of course. We know a bit about the region. We also have a lot of experience in centrifuge enrichment, whereas many of the other players, including France, United States, tend to do gas diffusion, which is a different kind of technology. But, you know, Russia's played its part. Russia is going to be taking some of the exported enriched uranium from Iran. China's played its part. China is going to be involved in the rebuilding of the heavy water reactor at Arak to ensure that that does not provide a plutonium route to nuclear weapons for Iran. France has done its bit in intervening and getting involved in the negotiation. The United States, of course, played a very powerful role, initially getting this whole thing begun through some bilateral private exchanges. So I think everybody has played an important role, Germany, of course, as well. Who knows whether this particular format of P5 plus one is something which can be brought to bear on some of the world's other crises. I do not know. I do think, I would make one comment, that from the Iranian perspective, if they're serious about implementing this deal, and we obviously devoutly hope they will be, but if they do want to implement this thing, then there must be an opportunity for them to conclude that it's in their interest to once again become a responsible part of the international community. It's worth remembering that before Iran was seriously bad, Iran was regarded as seriously good by many of us. And when I lived in Iran donkeys years ago, before the revolution, you know, the biggest foreign mission in town was the Israeli mission. There was a very close cooperation in those days. There was between us and the Americans, French, Germans. We were all there. And Iran is a country with which we have got long history of dealing in a lot of different ways. But it's up to the Iranian people and the Iranian government to decide what path they wish to take in the future.
Finally, the tension from a lot of perspectives in these talks is this conflict between the notion of sovereignty and whether a government has the right to become a nuclear power purely on the basis of its sovereignty, and an overall question of does nuclear proliferation make the world a more dangerous place, and so therefore is an interest in constraining nuclear development in new countries. Given that a lot of time has passed since 1945 and the reasons why certain countries have nuclear weapons may no longer be as relevant as they once were, I suspect there might have been an opportunity for an Iranian diplomat to say to a British diplomat, what the hell do you folks need nukes for? Why don't you just get rid of them tomorrow? What would your response to that be?
I think my response would be, first of all, we are where we are. Secondly, back in the days of the Second World War, which was when the Brits were the ones who were leading the technological development of these weapons, which we then, of course, shared with our American friends when we had a few other things on our plate, these were things that we were doing, which turned out to be necessary to end the war in the Pacific in 1945. And which we have had to maintain since then, not least because other powers, particularly the Soviet Union, had nuclear weapons as well. What is more worrying is when you've got countries which develop nuclear military capabilities, which are not part of the NPT, with unnecessary proliferation. I think the NPT has been successful in that a number of countries which were on the verge of developing nuclear capability, Brazil, South Africa, even Libya, have chosen not to go down that path. The worrying thing is when other governments, North Korea is obviously one, but also we were deeply worried about the risk of nuclear conflict between India and Pakistan at one point. It's still something people need to watch very carefully because of the proliferation of nuclear weapons outside the international frameworks which we established to ensure that those of us who had nuclear weapons and felt we had to keep them thought were necessary to try to safeguard world peace.
So we're going to hold on to them for a while.
I think we're going to hold on to them for the time being. It is expensive, but we think it is necessary.
Ambassador, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Sir Peter Westmacott is the British ambassador to the United States.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
It's hard to believe that a law that perhaps most directly affected my life as a wheelchair user is 25 years old. The Americans with Disabilities Act. It was the first broad legal step to embrace inclusion and to welcome people with disabilities into the mainstream. It was a welcome I could feel back in 1990, but there was also a chill. The ADA came with provisions that allowed employers and business owners under certain circumstances to say it was an undue burden to comply, and so they could opt out. Over the years, you could feel where inclusion was the choice, and you could certainly feel where it was not. Today, the ADA is a model law for extending disability rights around the world, but the United States has a long way to go to be a model for inclusion. While the Paralympics has a much bigger global profile than it did 25 years ago, and the Special Olympics, convening in Los Angeles this weekend, is a much bigger event First Lady Michelle Obama will be attending the opening ceremonies. Outside of sports, people with disabilities still have an extremely difficult time getting jobs and being economically independent. Judy Heumann is a special advisor for international disability rights for the State Department. As a child with polio, she was barred from public school as a little girl, had to sue to get a teaching certificate as an adult because she was in a wheelchair. As an advocate today, she says the battles in the 21st century are about getting beyond symbols to real inclusion of people with disabilities.
You know, for me, because I had my disability when I was so young, I don't remember, I was 18 months old, I don't remember not having a disability. So my whole persona is around, you know, being an individual who's got a disability. But for people who acquire their disabilities later, what types of changes did you have to go through to be able to really see yourself as an equal member of society, or did you not have that problem?
Well, I think there's lots of changes. You have to rethink of yourself. You have to rediscover yourself physically. I think the diversity, not only of when people have their disabilities, but how their life proceeds after that, I think argues for an aggressive level of inclusion. When I went to college, there was only one building that was accessible, and all my classes had to be held in that one building, which was you know, a problem. I mean, we did what we could, but now that campus is accessible from one end to the other. And viewing that accessibility, I find to be very emotionally satisfying. What was it like to visit your school as an accessible example of a state-of-the-art school all of a sudden, when it certainly wasn't in your time?
So I went to Long Island University in Brooklyn. But what was very interesting at that time was there was a student newspaper on the campus. The students had done an interview of disabled students on campus about problems of accessibility. And at that time, the head of the psychology department said that students who had physical disabilities should not go to Long Island University because it was traumatic for us to go to the school when it wasn't accessible, as opposed to saying that the university needed to make itself accessible. Now there's no choice. You know, universities, when they're doing major renovations or when they're building new buildings, have to make them accessible. So the ability to really focus on participation, academic life, and life on campuses is much easier to address.
Has the higher rate of participation in the educational system by people with disabilities translated into employment for them? And have the veterans' preferences for veterans in who many of whom are disabled complicated efforts to get disabled people who aren't veterans, who don't have military service, into the workforce?
Well, I would say that employment is still the major area where more achievements need to be occurring. It's a combination of what the private sector is doing to recruit disabled individuals. It's also very important to be looking at, for those individuals who had their disabilities like before the age of 21, the kind of work experiences that they're getting. So are they participating in internships and mentorships? Are they able to come to an interview with the kinds of qualifications that companies are now looking more and more for people to have? And I would say, yes, things are improving, but a lot more needs to be done in that regard. I think for disabled veterans with significant disabilities, like for civilians with significant disabilities, the employment rates are not yet where they should be.
And so in either category, there's a lot of work to be done.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you experience this, but sometimes I experience, you know, talking to people who kind of are still looking through me because they can't quite grasp that I'm putting sentences together and able to have a conversation. Those people are in the minority, absolutely. But nonetheless, there are still too many people who don't really get that having a disability is just a normal part of our lives, and that, you know, we can make the same kinds of contributions as other individuals. Sometimes we need accommodations to be able to do that. But basically, the data also shows the level of accommodations that disabled people need overall is really very small.
I would confirm that experience of it being the minority, but it's still being there. People who are either intolerant or ignorant about the expectation that you're going to find someone with a disability in your day-to-day life. Most people believe that's the case, but there are plenty of people who look at you like you're from another planet.
One of the values of the 25th anniversary of the ADA, I believe, is that many people who didn't know what the ADA was and is now will have an opportunity to learn a little bit more about it. We see, you know, a growing number of younger disabled individuals who are participating.
Judy Heumann, thanks so much. And thanks so much for all the work that you've done over your very long career.
Thank you, too, John.
Judy Heumann is Special Advisor for International Disability Rights. 25 years of the Americans with Disabilities Act brought this comment from Robert. My wife and I have found the ADA to be a good start, but we've also found there are still many barriers in our daily lives. These barriers are unnoticed by the normal body, but stop my wife from enjoying full access, and that frustrates me. My biggest gripe is the lack of full accessibility on public transportation. Every day, The Takeaway involves listeners like Robert in the next day's program. You can keep the conversation going by text message. To get your voice heard, just text the word START to 69866. Of course, standard message rates apply. You can reply STOP to opt out.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. Featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
Pop stars, race, buttocks, feminism, music videos, and trophies from MTV. From such ingredients comes a stinging critique of American culture. Or is it just a narcissistic slap fight over award shows and who deserves the center of attention? In any case, it's Nicki Minaj versus Taylor Swift.
This one is for my bitches with a fat ass. She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts. This what you came, this what you came for. You get what you buy, this what you pay for. So haters gonna hate, 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 hate. Even though you out here looking so ungrateful, I'ma keep it moving, be classy and graceful. Winning funny rumors lie, and I know you heard about me, so hey, let's be friends. I'm dying to see how this one ends.
To help us resolve the meaning of all of this, our pal Latoya Peterson is here. She's owner of the website Rachelicious.com and editor-at-large at Fusion. Latoya, remind us of how this dispute burst into full view. And then, if you get that question right, your bonus question is, why should we care?
And it's a very good question, very good question. So like so many celebrity feuds these days, it started on Twitter. After the VMAs, Nicki Minaj was tweeting kind of about what she saw and what I think is very true about the inequalities that happen in award shows, where essentially I think the tweet started out with her pointing out that her video would have been much better received, her two videos for Anaconda and for Feeling Myself, if it was a different type of woman that was featured, if it was a different type of body type. In particular, I think she said skinny women. Nowhere in this does she ever mention Taylor Swift, but Taylor Swift, who herself is very, very slender and I think has gotten a lot of internet love for being very skinny. And so she decided that Nicki Minaj was talking about her and sent over this tweet that was like, you know, why are you dividing women? You know, I've always supported you. Like, maybe one of the men took your spot. And Nicki was like, no, 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 no. Like, what are you talking about? What is happening? The story was spun into this, like, epic beef, Nicki Minaj versus Taylor Swift. And it became kind of about the fight between two pop stars and not at all about the substance of what Nicki was tweeting, which is about kind of racial inequality and the way in which videos are evaluated and judged as good.
All right. Let me ask you a couple of questions. And I mean, first of all, how do you evaluate a video anyway? I mean, what's the difference between being nominated for best video versus, as Nicki Minaj was, being nominated for best hip hop video? And in at least one other category as well, she was nominated.
A lot of things, actually. So one, best video overall, right, is definitely a mainstream designation. It's very easy for particularly artists of color to get stuck into like the hip hop box or just like, oh, this is really, really significant in hip hop culture. When in fact, hip hop culture is pop culture. I think we've seen this not only in the United States, but globally. When it comes to the more, I think, conservative taste of the Academy, they're generally not willing to look at, not just the Academy, but also MTV. They're not willing to look at certain types of artists outside of their box, right? And looking at the whole that they're making to the contribution of the music industry, but rather, okay, well, Nicki is doing hip-hop, this is it. But Taylor, you know, she's selling so much, it's a big deal, and therefore she is a mainstream artist, and she gets to be the person for the overall video of the year. And so being locked out of these categories actually has a huge impact on their bottom line.
But let's just say Nicki Minaj is doing just fine in terms of her sales and in terms of her profile, right?
Well, yes and no. So Nicki Minaj has a very loyal fan base, and a lot of people who love her. But she hasn't reached the kind of like mainstream endorsement level, long-term career level that someone like Taylor Swift has, right?
Is that because she's skinny, or is that because Taylor Swift is doing mainstream pop and Nicki Minaj is deliberately doing a kind of challenging, sort of in-your-face style? I mean, Anaconda, let's just say, was about buttocks.
I mean, there's a reason why Francesca Remsey in her video, you know, S White Girls Say to Black Girls, had a Nicki Minaj moment in there, because people love singing along to Nicki Minaj songs. You know, you want to talk about Anaconda, but then like last summer or two summers ago, that hit was Boom 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 Bass, and that's a pop song, right? But it's not seen as the same, and I think that was Nicki's ultimate point, that bodies are seen as very, very different types of things. If Taylor Swift were to sing the same to do the same lyrics, or actually more appropriately, probably Miley Cyrus, the reception would be totally different than it is for Nicki Minaj. And she's aware of that on some level, particularly moving through the music industry.
All right, now,
and
I can...
interestingly enough, so is Katy Perry, who tweeted, you know, her support for Nicki Minaj.
And that's, I mean, I don't know what to make of that necessarily. I think that, you know, there's certainly all kinds of rivalries for all sorts of reasons within pop music. And I can totally, you know, accept the point that Nicki Minaj feels that black women aren't recognized in the pop music canon in the same way as their white counterparts are. I mean, she tweeted, "If your video celebrates women with slim bodies, you will be nominated for Video of the Year. Black women influence pop culture so much but are rarely rewarded for it." Now, she can have that feeling, but how do you explain Beyonce? How do you explain all of the stars in Motown? I mean, I think we have a problem with race in America. I just don't know if it's in this particular place.
Well, I think one of the interesting things when you look at particularly music history is you see how a lot of these black artists people love and enjoy never really truly enjoyed the same level of success. They had the same level of name recognition. But when you look behind, you know, particularly the finances of it, they didn't have the same money. They were, a lot of times, were being exploited by their managers. They weren't booked for these top shows in the same way other people were. Like, for example, people talk all the time about how, like, you know, amazing Taylor Swift sales were. But who tweeted like last week, the top selling artist of all time, the top selling artist according to the RIAA, it's Rihanna.
LaToya Peterson, thanks so much for helping us with that discussion and actually starting that discussion. Thanks.
Thank you.
LaToya Peterson is owner of the website Racialicious.com and editor-at-large at Fusion. That's all for today. You can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend, folks. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.